Well, good afternoon again, brethren. Once more, we're going to look into the book of Genesis and continue our sort of Bible reading with a little bit of Bible study as we carry on. We're now well into the second half of the book of Genesis, and today we'll continue with the story of Jacob and Esau, and we begin today in Genesis chapter 33. You may remember last time we had Jacob wrestling all through the night with this individual who turns out to be Jesus Christ. And now we're moving on to Jacob meeting up again with Esau after many, many years apart. Chapter 33 and verse 1. Now Jacob lifted his eyes and looked, and there Esau was coming, and with him were 400 men, which obviously looked perhaps rather threatening. So he divided the children among Leah, Rachel, and the two maidservants. And he put the maidservants and their children in front, Leah and her children behind, and perhaps his favorite, Rachel and Joseph last. Then he crossed over before them and bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. But Esau ran to meet him and embraced him and fell on his neck and kissed him, and they wept. Remember, when they parted, Esau was looking forward to killing his twin brother for having stolen the birthright blessings. Verse 5, and he lifted his eyes and saw the women and children and said, who are these with you? And he said, the children whom God has graciously given your servant. So Jacob was behaving, you know, in a fairly humble fashion here, calling himself Esau's servant. Then the maidservants came near, they and their children, and bowed down. And Leah also came near with her children, and they bowed down. Afterward, Joseph and Rachel came near, and they bowed down. So they're all, you know, bowing before Esau and showing, you know, great respect before him. Then Esau said, you know, what do you mean by all this company which I met? And he said, oh, these are to find favor in the sight of my Lord. But Esau said, I have enough, my brother. Keep what you have for yourself. And Jacob said, no, please. If I have now found favor in your sight, then receive my present from my hand, inasmuch as I have seen your face, as though I had seen the face of God, and you were pleased with me. Please, take my blessing that is brought to you, because God has dealt graciously with me, and because I have enough. And he urged him, and eventually Esau took it. Then Esau said, let us take our journey, let us go, and I will go before you. I'll lead the way back. But Jacob said to him, my Lord knows that the children are weak, and the flocks and herds which are nursing are with me. And if the men should drive them hard one day, all the flock will die. Please, let my Lord Esau go on ahead before his servant. I will lead on slowly, at a pace which the livestock that go before me and the children are able to endure, until I come to my Lord in Seir. So he says, look, you carry on back at a sort of normal speed, but I've got these young children, you know, teenagers, early 20s, plus all the flocks and herds. We've had a long journey already. I think we've got to move a bit more slowly. We'll come on behind at a more sort of gradual pace. It might be that Jacob was still slightly suspicious, a bit uneasy, and happy to have made amends, but still some distance between himself and his brother. And Esau said, now let me leave with you some of the people who are with me. But he said, well, what need is there? Let me and find favor in the sight of my Lord. So no, don't leave any of your 400 men here. You take them all back with you. So Esau returned that day on his way to Seir. And Jacob journeyed somewhere else, to Sukkot, built himself a house, and made booths or shelters for his livestock. Therefore the name of the place is called Sukkot, which means booths or shelters. Then Jacob came safely to the city of Shechem, which is in the land of Canaan, when he came from Padan Aram, and he pitched his tent before the city of Shechem. And he bought the parcel of land where he had pitched his tent from the children of Hamor, Shechem's father, for 100 pieces of money. Then he erected an altar there and called it El Eloah Israel, meaning God the God of Israel, which of course was Jacob's new name. Israel, which meant the man who saw God, or the man who prevailed with God. Chapter 34, headed the defilement of Dinah in my Bible. Verse 1, now Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. So remember now they're in rather strange territory. They've long since left behind Laban and so on, and now they're living in the land of the Canaanites. And so Dinah goes out to see the other girls in that area. Josephus, the Jewish historian, says there was a festival in the area, and she was probably going over to have a nosy at the festival and see the fabrics and the dresses and so on of the girls of that part of the country. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. So here's an early rape mentioned in the Bible. And it seems that Dan was fairly young at this stage. Best guesses are she was round about 15, 16, 17, something like that. A very young girl in, as I say, a strange area. And no sooner did she wander off to have a look at what's taking place than this young man, who was, as it says, in a way, the son of a prince, and probably quite a, one imagines perhaps an arrogant young man, perhaps used to getting his own way, and he's taken Dinah off and raped her. Verse 3, his soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, get me this young woman as a wife. It seems quite likely that in fact they were still holding on to her. So I guess it was a bit like abduction and rape. But now he wanted to formalize it as actually as a wife, rather than just keeping her perhaps against her wishes. Verse 5, and Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field, perhaps some distance away. So Jacob held his peace until they came. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, you know, perhaps some distance away. And the men were grieved and very angry, because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done. So you can imagine these young men were, you know, really very, very angry. And they were quite young men, probably themselves late teens and through their early to mid-20s. Not exactly, you know, mature adults, but young men with plenty of energy, and no doubt now seeking revenge because a disgraceful thing had been done in Israel. And it's interesting that these young men actually see themselves now as a tribe called Israel, because up to this point, you know, Israel has been just the name of their, or the new name of their father. But now they're saying that, you know, we, all of us, are Israel. It's now a tribal name, a sort of national name. Verse 8, but Hamor spoke with them, saying, the soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife, and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us, and take our daughters to yourselves. You know, let's all intermarry and be happy. So you shall dwell with us, and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it, and acquire possessions for yourselves in it. Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. So the offer appears to be, you know, why don't you just be part of our community? Just marry among us, and we'll marry among you, and we'll all be one big happy family. But of course, these were Canaanites. And you remember that, you know, Jacob was sent away from Canaan to find his wives, and Abraham sent, you know, his servant off to find Isaac a wife elsewhere, because they were not to intermarry with the Canaanite people. So this would not have been a good idea to have intermarried with the Canaanites in the first place. But young Shechem says, you know, name your price, you know, name your dowry. Verse 12, ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife. But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father and spoke deceitfully. And I think we know where they got the ability to be deceitful. Does seem to run somewhat in this family. And because he had defiled Dinah, their sister. And they said to them, no, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. Right? Which, of course, is complete fabric, a complete lie. There's no intention whatsoever of any of that taking place. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone. I think take the daughter because she was actually still probably kept in somewhat captivity. And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. And Hamor and Shechem his son came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, these men, you know, the Israelites, are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for indeed the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives. Let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people, if every male among us is circumcised as they are circumcised. Will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them, and they will dwell with us. So, you know, Hamor's giving some sort of economic reasons why this might be a good idea to the other people in the city. You could see that, you know, Jacob was pretty wealthy. You know, many servants, flocks and herds and all the wealth passed down from Abraham and Isaac and so on. And it's a question of, well, you know, this is a pretty wealthy crowd. If we sort of intermarry with them, we get access to all of that tremendous wealth. It's a pretty good deal. That's what he's trying to sell to the people in the city. Verse 24, and all who went out of the gate of his city heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of his city. And of course that set the scene for the next events, because circumcision is, for adult males at least, a jolly painful procedure. That's why it's normally done at age 8 days among those who understand what the Bible teaches about circumcision. 8 days, apparently, the sort of blood clotting processes in the male body are at their peak. If you circumcise at aged 4 or 5 days, or at 20 or 30 days or 3 months, or in this case 20 or 30 or 40 years old, it's far more painful and takes far longer to heal. But at 8 days, which is what the Bible says, it's actually the perfect time if one wants to go down that particular route. Verse 25, now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, and no doubt walking about rather tenderly, that two of the sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. Dinah was the daughter of Leah, and Simeon and Levi were also sons of Leah, so it was actually, you know, their direct sister. You know, some of Dinah's other brothers were, you know, sons of Rachel or, you know, others. Verse 26, and they killed Hamor and Shechem his son with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. One presumes she was more or less imprisoned there. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the city, because their sister had been defiled. One imagines that the other brothers were also involved here, not just Simeon and Levi. No doubt Reuben was involved, and the others too. And, you know, remembering that they were probably just young men in their late teens and early to mid-twenties, you know, it was quite a ferocious attack, one imagines. And these young men, perhaps quite undisciplined. They took their sheep, their oxen, and their donkeys, what was in the city, and what was in the field, and all their wealth, all their little ones and their wives they took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. So they rampaged, pillaged, and they carted off the lot. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites, and since I am few in number, they will gather themselves together against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" They were still indignant over this whole affair. It looks a bit interesting that Jacob was somewhat nervous because, you know, God already promised to be with him and protect him and bless him. But it looks like when he saw that they'd destroyed this, relatively small city and put the individuals to the sword and carted off all the ladies and young folk and all the possessions, Jacob was now worried, well, hang on a second. The rest of the cities and towns around Canaan are going to hear about this. And there's only, you know, perhaps a few hundred of us. They're going to gather up armies. They're going to come, they're going to wipe us out, and we'll be destroyed and killed. What have you done to me? Why have you done this? You're too hot-headed. But they said, come on, you know, this was our sister, you know, a virgin in Israel, a maid in Israel. Why should these Canaanites think they could do that and get away scot-free? So we've done the honorable thing. Chapter 35. Then God said to Jacob, "Arise, go up to Bethel and dwell there." And perhaps, of course, that also satisfied Jacob, who was rather nervous in that area. "And make an altar there to God, who appeared to you when you fled from the face of Esau, your brother." And perhaps, of course, now you're fleeing again. "And Jacob said to his household and to all who are with him, put away the foreign gods that are among you. Purify yourselves and change your garments." And some people think, well, these foreign gods that are mentioned, was that foreign gods among the sons of Jacob, the sons of Israel? And probably not. It's probably that among those who are taken captive elsewhere, such as in Shechem, that there may have been a number of foreign gods and so on and so forth there. And what Jacob's saying is, look, if any of these things are lying around, you know, dispose of them. "Then let us arise and go up to Bethel, and I will make an altar there to God, who answered me in the day of my distress and has been with me in the way which I have gone." So they gave Jacob all the foreign gods which were in their hands and all their earrings which were in their ears, and Jacob hid them under the terebinth tree which was by Shechem. And they journeyed, and the terror of God was upon the cities that were all around them, and they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. And so perhaps when they heard the news about what was done to Shechem, they might well have decided to chase after these Israelites and teach them a severe lesson. But it looks like, you know, God was still very much watching over Jacob, even if Jacob sometimes had doubts. And it says the terror of God was upon the cities. So as they, you know, made their way along the path towards Bethel, past town after town and city after city, God sent, you know, his terror among the people. Whether that was angels or whatever, we're not too sure. But whatever it was, it kept these people well back. And Jacob, oblique Israel, and his sons and flocks and herds and so on were able to make their way in complete peace, protected all the way along the journey. So Jacob came to Luz, that is Bethel, which is in the land of Canaan, he and all the people who were with him. And he built an altar there and called the place El Bethel, which is God, the house of God, because there God appeared to him when he fled from the face of his brother, which of course was many, many years before. Now Deborah, Rebekah's nurse, died, and she was buried below Bethel under the terebinth tree that was there. So the name of it was called Alon Bakuth, or the Terebinth of Weeping. Of course, we haven't heard of Rebekah since Jacob ran away many, many years before. And in fact, I don't think she is. Her death is not recorded anywhere in Scripture. Then God appeared to Jacob again when he came from Padan Aram and blessed him. So, you know, quite a special privilege for, you know, God to appear to you. Maybe you appeared to Jacob before, wrestled with him all through the night, and now appears again to Jacob. And God said to him, "Your name is Jacob. Your name shall not be called Jacob anymore, but Israel shall be your name. So he called his name Israel. And God said to him, I am God Almighty. I am El Shaddai. Be fruitful and multiply. This is interesting now, if you know our history of Israel. A nation and a company of nations shall proceed from you, and kings, plural, shall come from your body. So this is the tremendous birthright blessing that God promised to Abraham and to Isaac and now to Jacob. But an extra detail is now added. A nation, you know, a great nation, and a company or commonwealth of nations shall proceed from you. It's going to, somewhere along the line, split into two. One major nation, one powerful nation, one famous nation, one great nation, and also part of your descendants will become a company or a commonwealth or a group of nations. And kings, plural, shall come from your body. It's not just talking of, you know, one king of kings. We're talking here about multiple kings. The land which I gave Abraham and Isaac, I give to you, and to your descendants after you, I give this land. Then God went up from him in the place where he talked with him. So clearly God had been there, because it says that God went up or departed. So this was really quite an important appearance of God to Jacob. So Jacob set up a pillar in the place where he talked with him, a pillar of stone, and he poured a drink offering on it, and he poured oil on it. And Jacob called the name of the place where God spoke with him, Bethel. Then they journeyed from Bethel, and when there was but a little distance to go to Ephrath, Rachel travailed in childbirth, and she had hard labor. Now it came to pass, when she was in hard labor, that the midwife said to her, Do not fear, you will have this son also. And so it was, as her soul was departing, for she died, that she called his name Ben-Oni, which is, I think, son of sorrow. But his father called him Benjamin, son of my right hand, or son of my joy. So Rachel died, and was buried on the way to Ephrath, that is Bethlehem. And from memory, that is just a few miles north of Bethlehem, and Rachel's tomb is still there to this day. I know that we took, I think it was a coach or a bus, when we went to the feast in Jerusalem, we took a coach or a bus down to Bethlehem, and on the way down there you do pass Rachel's tomb. It's still a monument there to this day. Verse 20, And Jacob set a pillar on her grave, which is the pillar of Rachel's grave to this day. Then Israel journeyed and pitched his tent beyond the Tower of Eder. And it happened, when Israel dwelt in that land, that Reuben went and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and Israel heard about it. So, I mean, there are certainly plenty of family troubles with this family. You know, it's not that long since Dinah has been raped, and then the brothers gone off and slaying all the people of Shechem. But now, not too much later, we discover that Reuben, the firstborn, going in and actually sleeping with his father's concubine, you know, Bilhah. And Israel heard about it and no doubt was not at all pleased. And of course this was the event that brought about the Reuben being disqualified from the birthright. Because you would have thought, well, you know, Abraham passes the birthright to Isaac. Isaac passes the birthright to Jacob. It now goes to the firstborn, who is Reuben. But that's not how it happened. And this is where Reuben disqualified himself. If we turn, I think, to 1 Chronicles chapter 5, if you can find that for a moment. 1 Chronicles chapter 5 is a good time just to quickly check that out. Excuse me. One Chronicles chapter 5, and just reading in verses 1 and 2. It tells us, Now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel, he was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. Okay, so the birthright should have gone to Reuben, but because of his sneaking into bed with his father's concubine, it says that the birthright, the very important birthright, all the material blessings and so on, actually goes to the sons of Joseph. And we read that a bit later in the book of Genesis. And it tells us here that genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. It sort of jumps over Reuben. It says, verse 2, "Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a ruler, although the birthright was Joseph's." So the birthright blessings, the promises of race, of the multiplied descendants, of sea gates, of the wealth of the land, of great prosperity, skips over Reuben and goes straight to Joseph and his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh. Okay, back to where we were in Genesis. Back to chapter 35 and verse 22. "It happened when Israel dwelt in that land that Reuben went in and lay with Bilhah, his father's concubine, and mother, of course, of some of his brothers. And Israel heard about it, and no doubt the other brothers too, and I can imagine there was a lot of arguments and fussing and fighting and so on. More trouble in the family. Now the sons of Jacob were 12. The sons of Leah were Reuben, Jacob's firstborn, and Simeon, Levi, Judah, Issachar, and Zebulun. The sons of Rachel were Joseph and Benjamin. The sons of Bilhah, Rachel's maidservant, were Dan and Naphtali." You have to wonder what Dan and Naphtali made of their brother sneaking off with their mother. Verse 26, "And the sons of Zilpah, Leah's maidservant, were Gad and Asher. These were the sons of Jacob who were born to him in Padan Aram." And you can imagine that the brothers would have been fairly different in many ways, because although they all had the same father, there were four different mothers. And of course, many of your characteristics, your temperament, your looks and so on, come from your mother or from your maternal sort of grandparents. So although there were 12 boys here, all one father, it's quite probable they were very different in their outlook and temperament and even their appearance. Verse 27, "Then Jacob came to his father Isaac at Mamre," or Kiriath Arba, that is Hebron, where Abraham and Isaac had sojourned. So he's reunited after, you know, a couple of decades with his father, and that must have been, I'm sure, you know, very, very exciting time. I can imagine that Isaac was so delighted. I think he'd expected to die many years before, but he was still hanging on at this stage. Now the days of Isaac were 180 years, so really, a good long age. "So Isaac breathed his last and died, and was gathered to his people, being old and full of days. And his sons Esau and Jacob buried him." And of course, you know, that meant Isaac got to see Jacob again, and got to see Jacob's sons. So Isaac knew, you know, Reuben, and Isaac was introduced to Joseph and Benjamin. So they all saw their, you know, their grandfather. Chapter 36, we're probably just going to jump over. It's the history of Esau. It says, verse 1, "Now this is the genealogy of Esau, who is Edom." And Esau was named Edom, or nicknamed Edom. "Esau took his wives from the daughters of Canaan," which of course had not pleased at all his father Isaac. "Ada, the daughter of Elon the Hittite, Aholibama, the daughter of Anah, the daughter of Zibeon the Hivite, and Basemath, Ishmael's daughter, sister of Nebajoth." And then it lists in the rest of that chapter the various descendants of Esau, and it really is just a genealogy, you know, who begot whom, begot whom, begot whom. There's not a great deal, I think, we need to read in that. If you want to study into it, that's fine, and of course some of the names in there are quite relevant in later times. We discover the father of the Amalekites in there, and so on. But we'll pass on that chapter of just names and begettals, and carry on in chapter 37. "Now Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. This is the genealogy of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brothers, and the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and the sons of Zilpah, his father's wives. And Joseph brought a bad report of them to his father. There were four mothers and a bunch of lads. They'd already been busy doing a little bit of, pillaging and killing. And I guess they were like many young men would be, full of energy and not quite fully mature. And anyway, they were up to things that Joseph came back and faithfully reported to his dad. Hey, Dad, you should see what this lot are doing. And of course, that's bound to really impress his brothers. Now, Israel loved Joseph more than all his children because he was the son of his old age. Also, he made him a tunic of many colors. But when his brothers saw that their father loved him more than all his brothers, they hated him and could not speak peaceably to him. And of course, that's always a danger in a family for parent or parents to show more favor and be partial to one of the children. If you're going to look after and spoil one child, then the other kids can get rather jealous, become envious, and that causes more difficulty and trouble. So it really is important for parents to be a bit more even-handed and try to make sure they look after all the kids and love them all, pretty much equally. Verse 5, now Joseph dreamed a dream, and he told it to his brothers, and they hated him even more. Joseph, 17, perhaps lacked some discernment, lacked some judgment, and just blabbed, and this is what he said. So he said to them, please hear this dream which I have dreamed. There we were, binding sheaves in the field. Then behold, my sheaf arose and also stood upright, and indeed your sheaves stood all around and bowed down to my sheaf. Hey, what do you think of that then, lads? And his brother said to him, oh, shall you indeed reign over us, young whippersnapper, or shall you indeed have dominion over us? Don't forget that, Joseph was the second youngest. It's only Benjamin who was younger. These lads are now in their mid-20s. He's a young 17-year-old. So they hated him even more for his dreams and for his words. But Joseph wasn't finished yet. Then he dreamed still another dream and told it to his brothers and said, hey, look, I've dreamed another dream. And this time the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars bowed down to me. So he told it to his father and his brothers. And his father rebuked him and said to him, what is this dream that you have dreamed? Shall your mother and I and your brothers indeed come to bow down to the earth before you? And his brothers envied him, but his father kept the matter in mind. Jacob had had a few dreams himself, if you recollect. He's probably thinking, right, this is very, very mysterious. This dream's probably a significant dream, and it's sort of the meaning looks fairly clear, but how could this possibly come to be? Why would I, and Leah, who was still alive, of course, and his other, brothers, why would we be bowing down to young Joseph? It's very strange. So his father pondered it, and his brothers just spat and, just looked for a chance to beat this whippersnapper up. Verse 12, then his brothers went to feed their father's flock in Shechem. And Israel said to Joseph, are not your brothers feeding the flock in Shechem? Come, I will send you to them. So he said to him, well, here I am. Then he said to him, please go and see if it is well with your brothers and well with the flocks, and bring back word to me. So he sent him out to the valley of Hebron, and he went to Shechem. Now a certain man found him, and there he was, wandering the field. And the man asked him, saying, oh, what are you seeking? So looks like Joseph was walking about, couldn't find his brothers where perhaps they were supposed to be. And he's wandering about, looking here and looking over there, and a bit sort of puzzled. Finds this man, and the man says, well, you look like you're lost, young man. What are you after? So he said, well, I'm seeking my brothers. I'm seeking the Israelites. Where are they? Please tell me where they are feeding their flocks. It's interesting that the word their flocks actually is in italics here, and in verse 13 there is a possibility that the brothers had actually left the flocks and were off feeding themselves somewhere and doing a bit of merrymaking, perhaps a little bit of alcopops and a few bags of crisps and a bit of singing and dancing, and leaving the flocks busy looking after themselves. Verse 17, and the man said, well, they've departed from here, for I heard them say, let us go to Dothan, which was perhaps where the local pubs were, and the bars and the young ladies. So Joseph went after his brothers and found them in Dothan, which is perhaps where they weren't supposed to be. Now when they saw him afar off, even before he came near them, they conspired against him to kill him. This does not seem like perhaps the most balanced family one's ever come across. Apart from killing other people and having rapes and sneaking off their father's concubine, now they're about to, they're planning together and conspiring to kill their own younger brother. Then they said to one another, look, this dreamer is coming, or this master of dreams. Come therefore, let us now kill him and cast him into some pit, and we shall say, oh, some wild beast has devoured him. We shall see what become of his dreams. So it's not altogether a healthy relationship we see here. I think probably a good psychiatrist would have a heyday. But Reuben heard it, and he delivered him out of their hands and said, oh, hang on, let us not kill him. Remember, Reuben was the firstborn, the oldest, and should have been the wisest, but already had a rather black mark against his behavior. And Reuben said to them, shed no blood, but cast him into this pit which is in the wilderness, and do not lay a hand on him, that he might deliver him out of their hands and bring him back to his father. So Reuben had, you know, what he thought was a good idea. Let's just toss him into this big pit here in the ground, and that'll be it. And then he was planning to sneak back later and get him out of there and bring him back home. So it came to pass, when Joseph had come to his brothers, that they stripped Joseph of his tunic, the tunic of many colors that was on him. Then they took him and cast him into a pit, and the pit was empty. There was no water in it, just as well. And they sat down to eat a meal. So they don't seem to be too particularly distressed by their plans. Sit down and out come McDonald's and so on. Then they lifted their eyes and looked. Oh, hang on a second, there's a company of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead with their camels, bearing spices and balm and myrrh, on their way to carry them down to Egypt. Of course, in these old days, we didn't have the motorways and freeways, and there weren't big, you know, semis and articulated trucks and zooming up and down to Walmarts and Tescos and so on. In these days, you had to have camels with all the goodies, you know, on their backs, making their way from place to place. So where, obviously, the Israelites were sitting down here having their McDonald's burgers was clearly on a busy way from Egypt, and so here come the Ishmaelites. So Judah said to his brothers, what profit is there if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? And it's interesting that the first words of a Jew recorded are, what profit is there in this? It seems that the Jews have always had a good eye for making some money. Oh, come on, what profit if we just beat his brains in and leave him here? Come, let us sell him to the Ishmaelites, and let not our hand be upon him, for he, after all, he is our brother and our flesh. Oh, we can hardly harm the poor lad. He's part of our flesh and blood. On the other hand, we could flog him for a bob or two. And his brothers listened and thought, hey, good idea, Jude. Then Midianite traders passed by. So the brothers pulled Joseph up, and one can imagine perhaps he was thinking that was they've forgiven me now. They've thought twice about it, and they're going to pick me up and give me some grub and send me back home. But I'm afraid his hopes were to be dashed. And lifted him out of the pit and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. And they took Joseph to Egypt. So poor old Joseph, 17 years old, and the apple of his father's eye, wearing this fancy robe and having all these special dreams from God. And now he's off as a slave, virtually, at 17 into Egypt. Then Reuben returned to the pit, obviously been missing for a while, and indeed Joseph wasn't there, and he tore his clothes, he was so upset, and he returned to his brothers and said, the lad is, he's not there, he's no more. And I, where shall I go? Where shall I hide? What shall I do? So poor old Reuben's in a bit of a tiz-was at this point. So they took Joseph's tunic, killed a kid of the goats, and dipped the tunic in the blood. Then they sent the tunic of many colours, and they, that's the messengers I guess, brought it to their father and said, we've found this, do you know whether this is your son's tunic or not? And he recognized it and said, oh, it is my son's tunic. And of course you can see the blood all over it. Oh, a wild beast has devoured him. Without doubt, Joseph is torn to pieces. Then Jacob tore his clothes, put sackcloth on his waist, and mourned for his son many days. And of course the brothers were some way behind at this stage. They'd sent on the tunic ahead of them, perhaps not wanting to be there at the early stage of the dismay and distress of their father. And all his sons and all his daughters arose to comfort him, but he refused to be comforted and said, for I shall go down into the grave to my son in mourning. Thus his father wept for him. And of course all the brothers knew what had happened, but they just watched and saw the father in mourning, you know, day after day, weeping, going around miserable and unhappy. And so it's a pretty strange family, you've got to say, and some really, it looks like, quite nasty personalities there. Now the Midianites had sold him in Egypt to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh and captain of the guard. So as a slave he was passed on to this man Potiphar. The word officer of Pharaoh, a number of modern translations say a eunuch of Pharaoh, because the Hebrew, the primary meaning of the Hebrew term is actually a eunuch of the Pharaoh and the executioner of Pharaoh. It seems that, you know, captain of the guard really meant being captain of the bodyguard, which meant essentially when the Pharaoh didn't like somebody, that you basically took his head off. So it looks like Potiphar was the man who was head of the executioners and also a eunuch. And being a eunuch might explain some of the behavior of Potiphar's wife a bit later on. So on to chapter 38. It came to pass at that time that Judah departed from his brothers and visited a certain Adullamite whose name was Hira. And Judah saw there a daughter of a certain Canaanite, whose name was Shua, and he married her and went in to her. So she conceived and bore a son, and he called his name Ur. She conceived again and bore a son, and she called his name Onan. And she conceived yet again and bore a son and called his name Shelah, which of course to us today is a sort of girl's name, but Shelah was then a boy's name. He was at Kesib when she bore him. Then Judah took a wife for Ur, his firstborn, and her name was Tamar. So you can see a number of years had passed here, because clearly Ur was now, you know, relatively adult. But Ur, Judah's firstborn, was wicked in the sight of the Eternal, and the Eternal killed him. You know, it's rather impressive, I guess. So God was watching events, and there was things happening here that he was not at all pleased about. So it looks like, you know, Jesus Christ, as he then was, the Logos, the spokesman, intervened and slew Ur. And Judah said to Onan, go into your brother's wife and marry her and raise up an heir to your brother, which was, of course, you know, the custom, the culture, and the law. But Onan knew that the heir would not be his. And it came to pass when he went into his brother's wife that he emitted on the ground lest he should give an heir to his brother. And the thing which he did displeased the Eternal, therefore he killed him also. So there's lots of activity in these days. You know, there's raping or adultery or slaying people or selling your brother into slavery and all this carry on. The National Enquirer or the News of the World have a heyday with some of these goings on. Then Judah said to Tamar, his daughter-in-law, okay, remain a widow in your father's house till my son Shelah is grown. For he said, lest he also die as his brothers did. And Tamar went and dwelt in her father's house. So she was to wait until Shelah was grown up. Now in the process of time, the daughter of Shua, Judah's wife, died. And Judah was comforted and went up to his sheep shearers at Timnah, he and his friend Hira, the Adullamite. And it was told Tamar, saying, "Look, your father-in-law is going up to Timnah to shear his sheep." So she took off her widow's garments, covered herself with a veil, and wrapped herself, and sat in an open place which was on the way to Timnah. For she saw that Shelah was grown, and she was not given to him as a wife. So what happened to Judah's promise? You know, you just wait there. Wait as a widow, wear widow's outfits, and when Shelah's grown up, you know, he will carry on the tradition, and will marry you, and so on and so forth. And it hadn't happened. So she obviously wasn't willing to wait much longer, and had certain plans in her mind. When Judah saw her sitting there by the wayside and so on, all dressed up in a certain way, he thought she was a harlot because she had covered her face. And so Judah should have passed on by, but Judah had got his personality problems and was not necessarily the most saint-like of individuals. Then he turned to her, by the way, and said, "Oh, please let me come in to you." For he did not know that she was his daughter-in-law. Gets really very confused, doesn't it? This is like a Peyton Place of 4,000 years ago. So she said, "What will you give me that you may come in to me? Let's have a bargain. What's the fee to be?" And he said, "I'll send you a young goat from the flock. That's worth a few bob." And she said, "But I'm not sure I can trust you, man. You're a stranger after all. Will you give me a pledge? You know, something to hold on to till you send me this young goat in payment?" Then he said, "What pledge shall I give you?" So she said, "Well, your signet and cord, and your staff that is in your hand." Then he gave them to her, and went into her, and she conceived by him. I suppose matters, you could argue, go from worse to worse in some ways. So she arose, and went away, and laid aside her veil, put on her garments of her widowhood, so back home. And she's dressed once again as the widow waiting patiently for Shelah to be given to her. And Judah sent the young goat by the hand of his friend, the Adullamite, to receive his pledge from the woman's hand. But of course, he did not find her. So he gets his young goat and says, "Okay, pop down the road. There's a harlot there by the wayside, just under the lamppost. When you find her down there, give her this young kid. That's a payment. And when you get there, and she's got my signet and my staff and my cord, and you can bring them back." Of course, Hiram goes down, and there's no harlot there. In fact, there's nobody here. Then he asked the men of that place, saying, "Where's the harlot that was by the roadside?" And they said, "Harlot? There's no harlots around here, mate. Sorry, you're in the wrong place. You need to go down the road a bit. A couple of miles, that's where the harlots are." Puzzling. And he returned to Judah and said, "I can't find her." Also, the men of the place said that there aren't any harlots here. You know, you didn't make it up, did you? Then Judah said, well, let her take them for herself, lest we be shamed. For I sent this young goat, and you've not found her. So I guess, payment was due, and she's got something out of it, I suppose. And it came to pass, about 3 months after, that Judah was told, saying, "Hey, Tamar, your daughter-in-law has played the harlot. Furthermore, she is with child by harlotry." Because remember, she's a widow in widow's garments, and they can tell that she's putting some weight on this young woman. In fact, she's putting a lot of weight on the front, and she's leaning back with her shoulders, and hello, we think Tamar's been up to hanky-panky. She's been playing around. Oh, dear. So Judah said, "Right, bring her out and let her be burned. No harlots in this family. This family is made up of principled people, righteous and noble and of the highest moral standards. None of this when I'm around." When she was brought out, she sent to her father-in-law saying, "By the man to whom these belong, I am with child." And she said, "Please determine whose these are, this signet and cord and staff with the name Judah engraved on the side of it." So Judah said, Judah acknowledged them and said, "She's been more righteous than I, because I did not give her to Shelah my son, and he never knew her again." Now it came to pass, at the time for giving birth, so I guess 6 months have moved on, that behold, twins were in her womb. Yeah, plenty of twins around in these days as well. And so it was, when she was giving birth, that the one put out his hand, And the midwife took a scarlet thread, bound it on his hand, saying, this one came out first. Because remember, the firstborn, you know, always gets certain, you know, birthright benefits and blessings being the firstborn. So if you're going to have twins, don't get them mixed up. You know, that's a boy and a girl, you probably know which one was which. But here comes the first one, his arm comes out, pop this little red ribbon round it. And then it happened, as he drew back his hand, that his brother came out unexpectedly, boing. And she said, what? How did you break through? This breach be upon you. Therefore, his name was called Perez. Afterward, his brother came out, who had the scarlet thread in his hand, and his name was called Zerah. So two twins, Perez and Zerah, sons of Judah, by Tamar, his daughter-in-law. And those twins become rather important when you're following the descendants of Judah all the way down to our present queen. Chapter 39, back into Egypt. Now Joseph had been taken down to Egypt, if you remember, and handed over as a slave, or sold as a slave, to Potiphar, the eunuch who was the captain of the executioners. And Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian, bought him from the Ishmaelites who had taken him down there. The Eternal was with Joseph, and he was a successful man, and he was in the house of his master, the Egyptian. And his master saw that the Eternal was with him, and that the Eternal made all he did to prosper in his hand. So Joseph was a young man still, perhaps about 19 or 20, whatever, but very prosperous, very wise, made good decisions, was older than his years. And God was watching over Joseph, had great plans for him, as we find out later. In fact, vital plans that were necessary to even save the whole Egyptian people and even the rest of the Israelites. So God was watching and prospering Joseph. He was, I'm sure, a very good young man, a man of high standards. So Joseph found favor in his sight and served him. Then he made him overseer of his house, and all that he had he put in his hand. So even though Joseph was quite young, but if it says, look, Joseph, you're in charge, this entire household, and remember, I'm a big, important bigwig in the court of Pharaoh. I've got a big house and lots of servants and so on and so forth, but you're in charge. So it was, from the time that he had made him overseer of his house and all that he had, that the Eternal blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake. And the blessing of the Eternal was on all that he had in the house and in the field. So I guess, Potiphar had perhaps estates as well, and cattle and herds and crops, and would be a very important man, Potiphar. So Joseph is now in charge of perhaps the estates as well. So he left all that he had in Joseph's hand, and he did not know what he had, except for the bread which he ate. And Joseph was handsome in form and appearance. So I guess taking after Jacob and Rachel, particularly good-looking young man, and now obviously a very successful young man, the executive virtually running Potiphar's household and estates. Now it came to pass after these things that his master's wife cast longing eyes on Joseph, and she said, lie with me. So Joseph, good-looking young man, that's of aura of success about him. Everything he did was turning to gold. And if Potiphar was a eunuch, then another reason why perhaps this young woman was casting longing eyes on this handsome young Israelite. But he refused, because Joseph was a young man of high standards and very wise in very many ways. And he said to his master's wife, look, my master does not know what is with me in the house. He has committed all that he has to my hand. He puts his complete trust in me. There is no one greater in this house than I. And remember, he's 20, 21, whatever age he is. Nor has he kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And remember, this is still many, many years before Mount Sinai and the Ten Commandments, but adultery was known to be sin and wickedness even in this time. So it was, as she spoke to Joseph day by day, that he did not heed her to lie with her or to be with her. So like a typical woman, you know, she just goes on and nag, 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 day after day, day in, day out, week after week, keeps sidling up to him and fluttering her eyes at him and endeavoring to try and induce him or seduce him. But he doesn't lie with her, and in fact, doesn't even be with her. He, you know, uses his sense and he keeps well away. If she comes down one corridor, he darts up another. If she comes in one door, he's out the other one. But it happened about this time, when Joseph went into the house to do his work, and none of the men of the house was inside, that she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me!" But he left his garment in her hand and fled and ran outside. So she found an opportune moment. Nobody else around, just Joseph and me. And she sidles up and once again, you know, makes her play. But, you know, Joseph doesn't hang about to negotiate or to argue, just darts out the door and away. But, of course, she's hanging on to his garment, perhaps his scarf or his jacket or whatever. And so it was, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and fled outside, that she called to the men of her house and spoke to them, saying, "See, he has brought this," he being her husband, "has brought into us a Hebrew to laugh at us, to mock us. He came in to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. And it happened, when he heard that I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled and went outside." And we all know that hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And here's a scorned woman about to vent her fury and her wrath upon poor old Joseph, who despite being a good young man and doing lots of good things, gets a rather surprising reward. So she kept his garment with her until his master came home. Then she spoke to him with words like these, saying, "The Hebrew servant whom you brought to us came in to mock me. So it happened, as I lifted my voice and cried out, that he left his garment with me and fled outside." So it was, when his master heard the words which his wife spoke to him, saying, "Your servant did to me after this manner," that his anger was aroused. And of course, you know, being chief of the executioners, that could have a certain outcome. Then Joseph's master took him and, thankfully at least, put him into prison, a place where the king's prisoners were confined, and he was there in prison. So at least he wasn't executed. But the Eternal was with Joseph and showed him mercy, and he gave him favor in the sight of the keeper of the prison. But nonetheless, you can only imagine what was in Joseph's mind at this time. You know, he'd been a good son to his father. He'd ended up being sold as a slave at 17, brought down to Egypt, sold to Potiphar. He had worked hard at Potiphar's household, been again a young man of very high standards and values. Potiphar's household had been blessed, and Joseph became, you know, second in command of the entirety of Potiphar's household. And here's Joseph, you know, avoiding sin, trying to keep himself squeaky clean, runs away from temptation and from this embarrassing situation. And how does he end up? Rewarded. He's in prison. But even in prison, you know, God continues to watch over Joseph, because there is a plan being worked out here, of course. Verse 22, "And the keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners who were in the prison. Whatever they did there, it was his doing. The keeper of the prison did not look into anything that was under Joseph's hand, because the Eternal was with him, and whatever he did, the Eternal made it prosper." So even in prison, you can't keep a good man down. And God's watching over Joseph and blessing things, but nonetheless, you know, being in prison can't be the most comfortable place. One imagines that Potiphar's household would be quite a nice property, probably very nice bedrooms, and of course, shower facilities and swimming pools and all sorts of pleasant fruits and vegetables and nice crunchy bread and so on, and other servants. And Joseph, don't forget, had been the second in command. Now he's gone from that, and now he's in prison. You know, quite a challenge for a young man to remain, shall we say, faithful and keep his integrity and not despair and start cursing God, thinking, "Well, hang on a second, I'm trying to serve God and look what happens to me. That's enough of that God for me. This wasn't part of the bargain. All I want is blessing after blessing. No, I'm out of here. Sorry, I'm going to find another decent God to worship, perhaps Baal or somebody." But nope, Joseph had a really strong character. On to chapter 40. It came to pass after these things that the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt offended their lord, the king of Egypt. And Pharaoh was angry with these two officers, the chief butler and the chief baker. So he put them in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, in the prison, the place where Joseph was confined. And of course we can see here, like a chessboard, certain pieces are being moved around to bring about a certain outcome. And the captain of the guard charged Joseph with them, and he served them. So they were in custody for a while. Then the butler and the baker of the king of Egypt, who were confined in the prison, dreamed a dream, both of them, each man's dream in one night, and each man's dream with its own interpretation. And Joseph came in to them in the morning, and looked at them, and saw that they were sad. Well, I mean, you'd be sad anyway, I guess, in prison, but they'd had these dreams and were now particularly sad. So he asked Pharaoh's officers who were with him in the custody of his lord's house, saying, "Why do you look so sad today?" And they said to him, "We each have dreamed a dream, and there's no interpreter of it." And they knew these were like special dreams, particularly colorful dreams. It made a big impact on them. And Joseph said to them, "Do not interpretations belong to God? Tell them to me, please." Then the chief butler told his dream to Joseph and said to him, "Behold, in my dream a vine was before me, and in the vine were three branches. It was as though it budded, its blossoms shot forth, and its clusters brought forth ripe grapes. Then Pharaoh's cup was in my hand, and I took the grapes, and pressed them into the Pharaoh's cup, and placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand." And Joseph said to him, "Oh, this is the interpretation of it." So we can see here that God has given some phenomenal abilities to Joseph. He hears his dream, and either because of his general understanding or because God gives him special spiritual insight, he instantly knows what's going on. Joseph said to him, "This is the interpretation of it. The three branches are 3 days. Now within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift up your head and restore you to your place. And you will put Pharaoh's cup in his hand according to the former manner when you were his butler. Oh, but remember me when it's well with you, and please show kindness to me, make mention of me to Pharaoh, and get me out of this house. For indeed I was stolen away from the land of the Hebrews, and also I have done nothing here that should put me into the dungeon." When the chief baker saw the interpretation was good, he said, "Oh, wow, that's pretty good. I hope mine will probably mean the same thing." He said to Joseph, "Oh, hang on a second, Joseph, I also was in my dream, and there I had three white baskets on my head. In the uppermost basket there were all kinds of baked goods for Pharaoh, and the birds ate them out of the basket on my head." And Joseph thought, right. And perhaps he stopped for a while and just pondered, you know, how does one say this diplomatically? So Joseph Ransom said, "This is the interpretation of it. The three baskets are 3 days." The baker's thinking, "Oh yeah, so I'll be free in 3 days, will I? Within 3 days, Pharaoh will lift off your head from you and hang you on a tree, and the birds will eat your flesh from you." That would not have made his day any happier, would it? If he was sad beforehand, he's now extremely sad. Now it came to pass on the third day, which was Pharaoh's birthday, that he made a feast for all his servants, and he lifted up the head of his chief butler and of the chief baker among his servants. Then he restored the chief butler to his butlership again, and he placed the cup in Pharaoh's hand. But he hanged the chief baker, as Joseph had interpreted to him. Yet, unfortunately, the chief butler did not remember Joseph, but forgot him. I mean, how unlucky can you get? You know, all that Joseph's done is only 3 days earlier, and the butler is jumping about with glee, and probably sort of grimacing when he hears the baker being taken off to his head removed. And yet, despite that, you know, poor old Joseph is waiting there thinking, this is it. You know, in the morning, the butler would point out what happened and who interpreted the dream and all the rest of it, and that's it. Tomorrow, I'll be free. And a week later, he's still in the dungeon. Uh-oh, poor old Joseph. Sometimes you just cannot win. Chapter 41. Then it came to pass at the end of 2 full years, boy, this butler's got a pretty poor memory, that Pharaoh had a dream, and behold, he stood by the river. Suddenly, there came up out of the river 7 cows, fine-looking and fat, and they fed in the meadow. That looks quite nice. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them out of the river, ugly and gaunt. These are scrawny cows, and stood by the other cows on the bank of the river. And the ugly and gaunt cows, can you believe it, ate up the 7 fine-looking and fat cows. So Pharaoh woke. He'd never seen cows eating other cows before. I thought, that's a surprising dream. Anyway, he has another quick glass of cocoa and goes back to sleep. He slept and dreamed a second time, and suddenly 7 heads of grain came up on one stalk, plump and good. 7 again, you see. 7 plump and healthy things. Then behold, 7 thin heads, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. 7 scrawny heads of the grain. And the 7 thin heads devoured the 7 plump and full heads. So Pharaoh woke, and indeed, it was a dream. He's thinking, what was all that about? Now it came to pass in the morning that his spirit was troubled. You know, obviously God had sent these dreams and was stirring up Pharaoh's spirit in preparation for an amazing event to come. And Pharaoh was troubled, and he knew that there's something about these dreams. I mean, just what was that all about last night? And you know, I can still see these dreams. They're absolutely livid in my mind. And he sent and called for all the magicians of Egypt and all its wise men. And Pharaoh told them his dreams, but there was no one who could interpret them for Pharaoh. And they're all sort of saying, well, no idea what the 7s are. Fat cows and scrawny cows and heads of grain. I don't know about that. I've looked through all my dream books, but there's nothing about cows in there. This is puzzling. And while they're all standing looking at each other and scratching their heads and looking out the window and so on, then the chief butler comes to his senses, spoke to Pharaoh and saying, ooh, I remember my faults this day when Pharaoh was angry with his servants and put me in custody in the house of the captain of the guard, both me and the chief baker. Well, you see, Pharaoh, we each dreamed a dream in one night, he and I. Each of us dreamed according to the interpretation of his own dream. Now, there was a young Hebrew man with us, a servant of the captain of the guard, and we told him, and he interpreted our dreams for us. To each man he interpreted according to his own dream. And it came to pass, just as he interpreted for us, so it happened. He restored me to my office, and he hanged him. Then Pharaoh was impressed by this. You mean there's a young man in a dungeon who interprets your dreams accurately? Wow, get him. Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And he shaved, changed his clothing, and came to Pharaoh, because you can imagine, you know, the dungeon was not the Holiday Inn Express. Down there in your clothes, you'd be smelling of rat urine and old cabbages and this nasty beard with all bits and pieces in it and so on, and you would not be really ideal company for a Pharaoh. So they take him out, run him into the shower, scrub him down with all the best deodorants and so on, has a quick shave with his Mach 3, and when he's looking smart and handsome and so on, they bring him in now to the Pharaoh. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, okay, young man, I have dreamed a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. But I've heard it said of you that you can understand a dream to interpret it. So Joseph answered Pharaoh, saying, it is not in me. God will give Pharaoh an answer of peace. So I'm not going to take any credit for this. It's the God in heaven that gives this understanding of dreams. Don't look to me. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, behold, in my dream I stood on the bank of the river. I guess that would be the Nile. Suddenly, 7 cows came up out of the river, fine-looking and fat. Oh, big, fat, jolly beasts. And they fed in the meadow and gambled around and were happy as can be. Then behold, 7 other cows came up after them, poor and very ugly and gaunt. Such ugliness as I have never seen in all the land of Egypt. These were nasty-looking cows. And the gaunt and the ugly cows, can you believe it, Joseph? Ate up all the first 7, the fat cows. And when they'd eaten them up, no one would have known that they'd eaten them at all. But they were just as ugly as at the beginning. And so I just woke up in a start. Also I saw in my dream, and suddenly 7 heads came up on one stalk, full and good. Then behold, 7 heads, withered, thin, blighted by the east wind, sprang up after them. And the thin heads devoured the 7 good heads, you know, and I guess afterwards they were as thin and scrawny as before. So I told this to the magicians, but there's no one who could explain it to me. So I'm puzzled. You know, I just don't understand this. And I know it's an important dream. I want to know what it means. Then Joseph said to Pharaoh, right, the dreams of Pharaoh are in fact one dream. They have one meaning, Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he's about to do, which itself is quite remarkable, that God would actually give this understanding and this insight to the leaders of nations. But he did. He's shown Pharaoh what he's about to do. The seven good cows are 7 years, and the seven good heads of grain are 7 years. You see, Pharaoh, the dreams are one meaning. And the seven thin and ugly cows, which came up after them, are 7 years. And the seven empty heads blighted by the east wind are 7 years of famine. This is a thing which I have spoken to Pharaoh. God has shown Pharaoh what he is about to do. You know, there's warning here coming to this Pharaoh. Indeed, 7 years of great plenty will come throughout all the land of Egypt. You know, that's the seven fat cows and the seven fat grains. That's talking of prosperity and abundance in the field and abundance of crops and so on. But, verse 30, after them, 7 years of famine will arise, and all the plenty will be forgotten in the land of Egypt, and the famine will deplete the land. So the plenty will not be known in the land because of the famine following, for it will be very severe. You know, it's going to be so bad that people will forget about the good days. They'll just be absolutely starved, virtually to death. And the dream was repeated to Pharaoh twice, because the thing is established by God, and God will shortly bring it to pass. So that's the end of the dream. Joseph done as required, as requested. He's explained the dream to Pharaoh. But he doesn't stop there. You know, Joseph is a young man filled with insight and wisdom, and been greatly blessed as he's looked after the prison and Potiphar's household. So he continues on now, really, and either of his own understanding and wisdom, or because God adds it to him, he says, now therefore, let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man, and set him over the land of Egypt. This is what you ought to do, Pharaoh. This is what I think anyway, Pharaoh. Let Pharaoh do this. Let him appoint overseers or officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the seven plentiful years. So every year that comes, collect, you know, 20% of all the crops and so on. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming, and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine. You see, if there's seven bad years coming, Pharaoh, what you've got to do is start now. You know, collect 20% in these abundant, blessed, prosperous years, put it all to one side, then when the famine arrives, you see, you'll have plenty there to feed the people. That's what you ought to do, Pharaoh. Find somebody sensible, somebody with wisdom, somebody really good, and get them onto this task straight away. Verse 37. So the advice was good in the eyes of Pharaoh and in the eyes of all his servants. I thought, well, that's a great idea. What a fantastic idea. And Pharaoh said to his servants, well, tell you what, can we find such a one as this, a man in whom is the Spirit of God? I mean, wow, this young man's got it all. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, clearly there is no one as discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. So, wow, suddenly, Joseph, 1 hour earlier, he's in the dungeon, you know, chasing rats around, and now Pharaoh says, you're going to be over the entire empire of Egypt. Only in my personal throne will I still be in authority. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. And that was probably the world's greatest empire at that time. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck. You know, a golden necklace, no doubt, showing his seniority, his position, his authority. And now he's got the Pharaoh's ring on his hand. He can now, you know, impress that ring onto all sorts of things with the full authority of the Pharaoh. I mean, Joseph is now second in command of one of the wealthiest, most powerful, prosperous empires there is, with huge armies and so on, all now under Joseph. And he had him ride in the second chariot which he had, and they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. You know, so even the people would bow down to Joseph as he went past. It's an incredible changed to go from the dungeon to the head of Egypt in an hour and a half. And it just shows you how quickly God can change things when he wants to. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah, or something like that. And he gave him as a wife Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On. So Joseph went out over all the land of Egypt. Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Remember that Joseph was 17 when he was sold into Egypt, so 13, you know, long years had passed, much of it in prison. But now Joseph is number two, in practical terms really number one. He's making all the decisions. He's now got presumably a beautiful Egyptian wife, Asenath, and he's now in charge of Egypt. Amazing. Now, in the seven plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years, which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea, until he stopped counting, for it was without number. I guess initially it's, well, there's 5 bushels, and then 100 bushels, and 1,000 bushels, and 10,000 bushels, and 100,000 bushels, and then, hang on a second, don't bother recording it any longer, we just run out of numbers, there's so much of it. And to Joseph were born 2 sons before the years of famine came, whom Asenath, the daughter of Potipherah, priest of On, bore to him. Joseph called the name of the firstborn Manasseh, for God has made me forget all my toil and all my father's house. And the name of the second he called Ephraim, for God has caused me to be fruitful in the land of my affliction. And of course, these two boys of an Egyptian mother and an Israelite father, of course, have got a great deal of importance in the future generations, Ephraim and Manasseh. Manasseh the firstborn, Ephraim the younger born. Then the 7 years of plenty, which were in the land of Egypt, ended, as prophesied. And the 7 years of famine began to come, as Joseph had said. I guess some people probably doubted this whole story, but this was the proof. The famine was in all lands, but in all the land of Egypt there was bread. So when all the land of Egypt was famished, the people cried to Pharaoh for bread. Then Pharaoh said to all the Egyptians, go to Joseph, whatever he says to you, do. So it might take a few weeks, a few months, but suddenly people have run out of their own personal private stores and stock, and now they're starting to hunger. So they come to Pharaoh and say, you're the Pharaoh, you run the land, you're in charge, what should we do? He says, go speak to Joseph. The famine was over all the face of the earth, so not just in Egypt. And Joseph opened all the storehouses and sold to the Egyptians. And the famine became severe, again as prophesied, in the land of Egypt. So all countries came to Joseph in Egypt to buy grain, because the famine was severe in all lands. So all around for hundreds of miles, people heard that, hey, we're all sort of we're dying here. Nothing is growing. We're running out of food, having to kill all the cattle because they can't feed either. But then in Egypt, there's still stuff to buy. And so, as it says there, all countries sent emissaries and messengers, and people came down to Egypt where they could buy some of this grain stored up by Joseph, which of course brings us soon to his being reunited with his family. I think that's us for today. We've made very good progress. It might even be the case, if we race along, we might even finish, perhaps, Genesis next time. Not sure about that, but we'll do our very best anyway. So at that point, we leave Joseph in charge of Egypt, looking after the people and providing their sustenance day by day. And oh, no doubt, we can see that God's hand was involved there all the way along the line. Okay, we'll leave it for there now and take up again next time.